For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host Red Sale, and in this week's Christmas special, Tricia Ashley shares her recipe for a cosy romantic Christmas.
My readers seem to like a big cast of characters snowed up in a large house and seeing what happens. So that seems to be what they like, and lots of food.
Wizard drummer Charlie Greemer recalls a Christmas showdown on Top of the Pops.
We got custard pies, and I don't know where we got them from. And we waited till they were on camera, and we just slapped them on Noddy's face.
Queen of Christmas Sue Moorcroft finds snow and chocolate while researching her new novel.
There was a lot of Swiss chocolate involved. I brought some home from the Christmas markets. Some of it survived the trip home.
And Noddy Holder joins me in the studio for a special read-on glam rock and roll Christmas.
It was Jim's mother-in-law who said to him one day, "Why can't you write a song that would be coming out every year?"
That's all coming up in today's show. Tricia Ashley is the best-selling author of a string of romantic comedies, including Every Woman for Herself, which was nominated as one of the top three romantic novels of the past 50 years. Her latest book, The Christmas Invitation, is fast-paced, funny, and designed to melt even the most Scrooge-like heart. We met at the Royal Overseas League in London. Tricia Ashley, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be interviewed by you.
So it's fair to say that the heroine of The Christmas Invitation, Meg, is a bit bar humbug about Christmas, isn't she?
She was brought up in a commune where they only celebrated it as a pagan rite, so she's never experienced a true Christmas. So there are some pagan elements come into it, which I'm quite interested in, but it is all about her finding out what a real Christmas is like.
She's given the opportunity because she's invited to the Lancastrian countryside to paint a couple of portraits in time for Christmas.
Yes, that's right. I went to art college, and although I studied architectural glass, I have painted portraits. So I made her a portrait painter, and she is quite an impressionistic painter, so she paints fast. And she is more or less hijacked by a lady called Clara Mame Doom, who is an epigrapher, and also writes crime novels. And she's very forceful, so she steamrollers my heroine Meg into going to this remote house to paint two portraits.
Clara's an epigrapher, which, for those who don't know what that is, could you just explain?
Yes, it's the written word on any hard substance, clay, carved into stone, ivory, anything like that.
And she's married to a poet.
She's married to Henry Doom, who is a renowned poet of the old school. Both the Dooms are in their 70s, but they're still pursuing their careers, as it were. And he's turned down the poet laureateship a couple of times. He's quite a recluse.
And they could be a rather imposing couple and make Meg feel rather small, but actually they don't. It's rather a welcoming household.
It is run along a very sort of inclusive line, a bit like the commune she was brought up in. So they've gathered a rather strange set of people around them who are all friends. So Meg fits in instantly with this whole ethos. And I do like to have multi-generational setups. Older people, younger people, children, and the whole mix. Because older women especially are very, very interesting, the lives they've led, and they're often totally ignored in literature. So I like to show that Clara is very much on the ball. She spends a lot of time piecing old bits of pottery with inscriptions on together on her computer screen and that sort of thing. She's very techie. She's a lot more techie than I am.
And, as you say, there are younger characters in the book as well. And Meg begins to melt and feel the magic of Christmas.
She does. It's slightly held back because she meets somebody from her past that she's had a difficult relationship with, so that's not very welcome. But she soon gets sucked into the whole family and the whole idea of Christmas. And it is a big thing at the Red House where she's staying. There are lots of traditions.
It does sound a little bit like the sort of classic country house murder plot without the murder.
Yes, there is. I don't want to give anything away, but there is a bit of a suspense twist. There is often a backstory in my books, frequently quite dark, that impinges on what is happening now, and it's so in this book, something from the past comes back, which could really set the cat among the pigeons with other members of the family she's staying with. So there's always some mystery, something that has to be resolved.
It's not the first time you've written a Christmas book. A Christmas Cracker is also in the R&IB library. What is it about Christmas that makes you want to write?
The whole thing is just magical to me, and I like to share that with people. I think my most popular book was The 12 Days of Christmas, and in that, a lot of people have said, I learned how to cook everything you need to cook at Christmas by reading that book, because the heroine does it for a big house party, so she shows you how to do it, but not in a magazine, this has to be perfect way. You know, when I used to cook a turkey, I cooked it till the legs dropped off and then I knew it was done. There's no need to faff around, and you don't have to have chestnuts in with your sprouts. I think that's a weird idea. And just do your own thing at Christmas. I think that's how I've always done it.
This book as well has recipes in it, doesn't it?
Yes. This is a little different because the household, like me, are pescatarian. They don't eat meat, they'll eat a little bit of fish. So this comes as a surprise to one or two visitors, but it suits Meg because she's been brought up in a vegetarian household. So I thought it would be an interesting variation on how they do it.
And what do you think the vital ingredients for a Christmas novel are?
Well, going by the 12 Days of Christmas and this book, my readers seem to like a big cast of characters snowed up in a large house and seeing what happens. So that seems to be what they like, and lots of food. And, of course, I always have recipes at the back of my books, so they like those as well. I don't quite know. If I knew, I would probably keep on doing it forever, but I do like to write a different novel every time, so perhaps not.
Now, like me, you've lost your sight, and I know from personal experience that actually makes managing a 100,000-word novel quite difficult. How do you cope?
I think because I've been published since the early 80s, and I've always written, I write in a certain way which is not easy to adapt to vision loss. I'm trying to treat it as an exciting challenge, so I'm trying to evolve new ways of working all the time. But you try and evolve with each book anyway, so evolving the way you do it is just another aspect of it. It is a shock when you're first diagnosed and registered as legally blind, and it does take you some time to come to terms with it and think, well, I'll do it a different way then.
Presumably you started writing by hand and then graduated to word processors, and are you now using magnification software?
Well, I did write by hand, but at 15 I had an excellent English teacher who knew I wanted to write, and she got me onto 6 weeks of a typing course so I can touch type. I'm very fast but totally inaccurate touch typer. So I've always typed, and then I moved to the word processors, which those of you will remember the enormous thundering noise they used to make as they printed out. Then I moved on to computers, which do make life easier, except when the whole thing goes down or it loses your entire book. So now I find the research very difficult because I've got a whole giant bookcase full of wonderful old research books, and a lot of them are on shiny paper. So although I've got a desktop magnifier, it doesn't really like the shiny paper very much. So research can be difficult, but I can still do it in very large print on my internet computer. My work computer and my internet computer are always entirely separate.
I know that you, like me, are a huge fan of the R&IB library.
I am, yes. It's been absolutely wonderful because I've always been a fast reader and I usually get through a book a day or every other day if it's a big one. So I'm reading my way through the library at a rate of knots, and I keep making suggestions what they could add to it, the new books and series. I've got a USB stick player. It's black with yellow marks, so it's really easy, and it's simple controls. So I'm now thinking of getting the big version that plays CDs and tapes as well, and there's a radio, because I'm having trouble with my radiogram and tape player. I can't see the controls anymore.
Oh yes, there's a common problem that we all have. And my colleague Hannah noticed immediately when you came in that you have a rather blingy white cane.
Yes, I do. I had a struggle to find a really pretty cane to start with. It's a folding white one. And my son, who is a costumier, blinged it up for me because it was so boring. I wanted a bit of glitter. So it's got big rectangular sparkles around the top and then a smaller band on either side of, I think it's Swarovski crystal. So it's a blinged up stick.
Well, clearly you're not letting sight loss get you down. And you also must be delighted that you can bring pleasure to people through your books, very many of which are in the RNIB library as talking books.
Yes, a lot of people find my books very comforting and they get them through very difficult times. And that's very humbling to hear. And that people can go into my books and lose themselves, which is something I've done with other favourite authors. It just never ceases to amaze me that my books have that effect on people.
I think I detect a Lancastrian tinge to your voice, and I rather like your Lancastrian dark humour and kind of Welsh playfulness. Is that fair enough?
Yes, I'm a quarter Welsh, but I was born and brought up in Lancashire in St Helens. So my grandfather, who was chief scout master of the whole area, knew all about the old legends, the stories, the songs, the dialect. So I picked up a lot from him, and I've infused that into a lot of my novels, because I've invented an area of Lancashire which I call Tricia World, which stretches from the Lancashire Moors to Churchtown just above Southport, which I call Merchester. So that is my area.
And fans of yours will recognise some of the characters from your other novels as well, won't they, in The Christmas Invitation?
Yes, there's often a little bit of overlap. I don't write sequels, but some of the characters come in to various books. And some of the earlier ones, some are set in Yorkshire or Wales, they subscribe to Skintold Northern Woman magazine, which I invented in one of my very early books. So there are all these little threads which you don't need to know about, but those who have read the earlier books like to spot.
Well, Tricia Ashley, thank you so much, and I hope that you have a lovely Christmas.
Thank you, and I hope all my readers have a lovely Christmas too.
It'd have been another lovely family Christmas. She and Henry might have no children of their own, but her nephew and niece, Lex and Zelda, more than made up for that. And now, with Zelda's little boy, Teddy, living with them, there was a child in the house again to make Christmas extra special. The room was warm and bright. The clock ticked and time seemed to ripple around her. In moments like this, Clara often found herself thinking more and more about the past and how it linked to her present life. A train of thought stirred up by the brief autobiographical introduction she'd been asked to write for her last crime novel. To her surprise, she'd found that she actually had quite a lot to say about her life, not all of it suitable for publication. But it would be enjoyable to write her full and frank memoirs, if only for future generations of the family. With Clara, to think was to act. Minutes later, she had created a new document and was intoning the foreword to her autobiography into her microphone.
Emma Powell narrating The Christmas Invitation by my guest, Tricia Ashley. The Christmas Invitation is out now in print, ebook, and audio, and should be dropping down the RNIB library chimney soon. A wide selection of Tricia's other books is already there, including A Christmas Cracker, which is TB701015. It's narrated by Julia Barry. You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this festive special, The Queen of Christmas and The World According to Noddy. But first... Charlie Greamer was born in Malta and raised in Birmingham, where he played drums and percussion in several bands before finding fame in Wizard, whose hit single, I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, was only kept off the number one slot by Slade's Merry Christmas Everybody. But it's Charlie's work with Blind Children that has meant most to him, as I found out when he joined me down the line from his home in Kent. Charlie Greamer, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for pronouncing my name right as well.
That's a pleasure. There's a lovely reminiscence in the book of when you were a little boy drumming along to Edmundo Ross, the jazz musician, with spoons.
I think it was forks, actually, because you get that spring on the fork. And we had the... I remember the bed was metal, so you get that brr, brr on the... Yes, Edmundo Ross was a Latin American, cha-chas and rumbas and all that.
You very quickly got into what was quite a vibrant music scene in Birmingham in the late 50s, early 60s.
I lived in a place called Neachels, right across the road from Neachels Green Community Centre. It's also used for rehearsals. And I remember Ozzy and the boys used to rehearse there.
That really comes out in your book. What a close-knit community of musicians it was. You knew the guys from Black Sabbath.
Yeah. We were like a big family, really, because all the bands knew each other. There used to be a couple of places where you can get a steak pie late at night. And most evenings, you'd get all these vans turning up with bands, just come back from their gig from wherever, having a pie, chatting about what gig they've just done. And, oh, yeah, well, we did that last week. We went down all right. Or, you know, it was a terrible gig and a terrible venue. We just used to discuss over a pie, you know. There's lots of jamming going on. There was one particular club called the Cedar Club. We were the resident band, but they used to have guest artists coming from the States. People like Benny King, Rod Stewart, the Walker Brothers, Dwayne Eddy, Booker T and the MGs, the Platters. All sorts of people played there. And all the bands that weren't working that night would all come down to this club, you know. People used to get up on stage and have a jam with us. Like John Bonham used to come and play my kit and wreck it. Because he was quite loud. I used to hide my sticks when I saw him. Hide my best stick because I knew he was going to either break the sticks or put a skin through, which he did. And then he'd just give me a fiver at the end of the night or something and say, get yourself a new skin.
Yeah, I mean, John Bonham and Robert Plant were Birmingham boys as well before they joined Led Zeppelin.
That's right. Well, John Bonham was in a few bands, and then he was in a band called the Band of Joy with Robert Plant, because he was in a soul band when I first met him called Listen. But he was, deep down, he was a blues man, you know.
And it really comes out that because you all began your careers together, there were no airs and graces.
No, no. Later on in years, a lot later, when I was in London, I bumped into Robert Plant on the street. And I said, hello, Bob, how are you doing? And he went, hello, I've seen you for years and all this. So we went to a greasy cafe and we were just sitting there having a cup of tea and talking about the old days, you know. Afterwards, he gets in his Ferrari and I jump on the 73 bus.
As you say, you played in a wide variety of bands, but of course the one everybody's going to remember at this time of year is Wizard with Roy Wood.
One of two drummers in a band called Wizard in 1970s glam rock era. We had two number one hits. But the one that most people remember is the Christmas song, which is I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day. It's a tongue-in-cheek title for my book, which is Aren't You Glad That It's Not Christmas Every Day?
I believe your first gig was at Wembley Stadium.
That's right, 1972 Rock and Roll Festival. The main stars were Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bill Haley, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. That was one hell of an experience because there was 90,000 bikers or rockers, whatever. They came to see the main stars, really, and they were throwing beer cans at the band before us. I mean, we got away with it because of Roy Wood, I guess, because of the move. It was already had a name, you know.
Did you enjoy your time in Wizard? Was it a good band to play in?
Yeah. We had some lovely times. And when we went to the States, it was a revelation for me because I've never been to the States. We spent a lot of days in Hollywood, which was great because we actually recorded at Warner Brothers Studios. I loved it. I loved that bit of it. But it was a bit disorganized gig-wise because we had a lot of gigs pulled out for one reason or another. And also, at the time, We were 11 piece. We had loads of cellos and stuff. A couple of gigs we couldn't do because of the stage being so small. They just got cancelled.
I know that I Wish It Could Be Christmas was kept off the number one slot for Christmas in 1973.
By Slade.
But I believe you got your revenge on Noddy Holder on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, it was just a fun thing because we knew each other so well. We got custard pies, and I don't know where we got them from. And we waited till they were on camera, and we just slapped them on Noddy's face. But there was no malice whatsoever. It was all fun, you know.
Moving on to the Top of the Pop show. When we had the second rehearsal, we would have our costumes on. On one occasion, Roy, for some reason only known to him, decided it would be a good idea to put Keith, the other drummer, and myself in ballerina tutus. So Rick, the bass player, took us to Camden to Berman's, the theatrical costumers, to get these tutus. It took a considerable amount of scotch to get me to actually wear the damn thing, I can tell you. I remember that as we were on set before going on stage, I was having a conversation with Clem Cattini, one of the top session drummers in the UK. It was weird, because it wasn't until I was well into the chat that I happened to look down and I realised I was standing there with this bloody skirt on. We knew that bands used to mime on the show, so we didn't try to hide it. For instance, on the occasion with a tutu, Keith and I were nowhere near a drum kit. We were each twirling a double bass. Still, we had fun.
David John narrating Aren't You Glad That It's Not Christmas Every Day, written by my guest, Charlie Greemer. So, we must talk about the work that you did at Dalton House School for the Blind.
I was there as a teacher's assistant, but I used to do music as well. I did a bit of drumming with them and then started using keyboard connected to the computer and using a thing called Cubasis, which was a watered-down version of Cubase. What you got to remember is a lot of them weren't just blind. A lot of them couldn't use both hands. They were in a wheelchair, so they couldn't sit behind a drum kit properly. But the keyboard thing helped a lot because it wasn't a lesson as such. It was therapy, really.
I believe you were there for 15 years.
16 years, yeah. I did all sorts of things. I did fundraising. I got loads of my friends come down and we put concerts on and raised funds.
You used your showbiz connections both in music and in acting.
That's right, yeah. I kept in touch with people in London, you know, once I moved down here. Because at first, when I started at Dalton, I was still living in London. I was just coming down for like 3 hours on a Tuesday, I think it was. And I did that for 5 years. And one thing led to another, and I was asked, there was a different principal there. He said, look, there's a drum kit gathering dust upstairs. I started doing it full-time, more or less.
Clearly, from the way you write about it, a very rewarding and humbling experience for you, but there were also very talented kids there.
That's exactly, yeah. That was my first experience, close experience, with what it's like to have a vision impairment. It's just amazing. There was one lad, I think I wrote about this lad, he was into country and western music, and he asked me if I ever heard of Raymond Froggatt, and I said, definitely, I know him very well, I was in his band once, he came to my wedding, and he couldn't believe it, this kid, because he thought that nobody had ever heard of him. He used to come up to me on a Monday and say, have you managed to go up to Birmingham, have you seen Raymond? And the one time I decided to do it, and I went up to Birmingham. And I explained to Raymond, I said, look, can you do something, you know, give me something, memorabilia. So he gave me an album. I had somebody braille on the thing to Melvin, best wishes from Raymond Froggatt, keep on writing. This kid was very talented. He played piano, played bass. He wrote songs and he knew all Raymond Froggatt's songs, you know. It still brings a tear to my eye when I tell people about it because it was quite moving, you know. When I said to him at the end of the lesson, I said, Melvin, I said, I think you left something behind. No, sir, I didn't bring anything. I said, well, there's an LP here. I don't know. It's got Braille in it. I can't read Braille. So I got him to read it, you know. And when it said to Mel, you know, his face just lit up.
With all the achievements that you've had in your life, it came through very strongly that you clearly feel that your time at Dalton House is the most rewarding.
Yeah, it was... I don't want to sound as if I'm being heroic, but I put my career on the back burner because I couldn't do the two things once I was working there full-time. Strange one, really, but that's the way it goes, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've written your memoirs.
I had no aspirations of being a writer, you know. I just wrote it down. And everybody says to me, who's read the book, they said, it's just like having a conversation with you. I didn't put any frilly bits and all that. So, yeah, I enjoyed doing it, really.
And clearly it was very important for you that it was made available as an audio book as well, a talking book. It's nice to have your voice at the beginning of it, giving the introduction, and it's available in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, mate. Thank you. Take it! I
wish it could be Christmas. After a few years of friends encouraging me to write about my times in this business of showing off, I decided to give it a go. I started from the humble beginnings of emigrating to the UK in the hope that you get a grasp of the culture shock of change that I have experienced. For the better, of course. I'd like to think that I have grasped the Brummy sense of humour along the way. All right. I'd just like to say that I really enjoyed writing the book. I hope you enjoy reading it. And I'm very grateful for a dear friend of mine, called David John, who's going to be narrating this book for you. Please enjoy Charlie Greenman, ex-drummer of Wizard. Used to be a pop star, but I'm all right now. Cheers.
Aren't you glad that It's Not Christmas Every Day is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB21990, and it's narrated by David John. Christmas is the time of giving, and to donate £5 to RNIB this Christmas, please text SANTA to 70456. Texts are charged at £5, plus your standard network rate charge. Your special gift will help more blind and partially sighted people get the support that they need to live life to the full. Thank you. See Christmas differently with RNIB Connect Radio. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later in this Yuletide special, Noddy Holder on Slade, Christmas and custard pies. But before that... To her legions of fans, Sue Moorcroft is the Queen of Christmas. Her best-selling Yuletide romances are the perfect accompaniment to a mince pie and a glass of mulled wine by the fireside. Up till now, these winter's tales have been set in the fictional village of Middledip, but this year she's gone travelling. Sue joined me down the line to tell me why. Sue Moorcroft, welcome back to Read On.
Hi, Red. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The new book, Let It Snow, has just come into the RNIB library. Could you set the scene for us a bit?
Let It Snow is about Lily. She is from a same-sex family. She has two mums. And obviously, in that circumstance, a man has to be involved somewhere along the line to create the babies. And she'd always assumed, or always been told, that she was the product of a one-night stand, whereas her sister Zinnia is from a sperm donor. And then she discovers her mum crying over an obituary and realises that she's not the product of a one-night stand. Her mother actually had an affair with a married man. And although she's found and lost her dad in the same minute, she does realise she has two half-brothers to discover. So she sets off to do that, and her search takes her from the frosty cottages of the little town of Middledip in Cambridgeshire to the snowy mountains of Switzerland, along with a singing group, her boss, and a Dalmatian dog.
Sounds great fun. Did this involve a fact-finding trip for you?
It did. I have an author friend, Rosemary J. Kine. She lives between Yorkshire and Switzerland, and she said to me, if you want to come with me, if you want to set a book there, you can. So I said, I want to set a book there. And that's how it all happened. And we drove across Europe, or rather Rosemary drove across Europe, and I sat in the front with her Swiss Mountain dog in the back, Wilma. I must name check her or she gets upset, I'm told. And we did everything really that my characters do. We stayed overnight in France. We went to all the Christmas markets. We visited one of the most expensive service stations in Europe. We went and saw a singing Christmas tree, which was actually a pyramid-shaped stage with a choir on it. All the masses of lights, the lakes, the lantern walks, the processions, it was all absolutely amazing.
It sounds magical. And was there a bit of Swiss chocolate involved as well?
There was a lot of Swiss chocolate involved. I brought some home from the Christmas markets. Some of it survived the trip home. And my husband said, when I gave him a parcel, we don't bring presents home from trips for each other. Oh, chocolate. So obviously it was an acceptable gift. And it was the same on Christmas Day, my son and daughter-in-law. Oh, Swiss chocolate. Yeah, it's very nice.
You started a new tradition.
Yeah. I'm going to Sweden this December for a research trip. So they'll get the opportunity to compare Swedish chocolate to Swiss.
Well, yes, of course, you write these books a good year in advance and then do the editing a little bit closer to publication date, don't you?
That's right. It's the only way to make it work, really. Two books a year, summer and winter, I write for Avon HarperCollins. At the moment, I am a fifth of the way through the first draft of the Swedish book. And then I've had to break off to do the editing on the 2020 summer book, which is called Summer on a Sunny Island and is set in Malta.
What do you think the vital ingredients for a Christmas novel are?
Well, I think that the story has to be firmly arranged around Christmas. It's a bit difficult to persuade readers that it's Christmassy if you just throw in the odd Christmas tree here and there. So I bring in Christmas as early as I can. I make the story at least a better story for taking place at Christmas. It's one of those things, Christmas, isn't it, that most of us tend to think of it as a wonderful time. Oh, I'm looking forward to Christmas, I'm going to see whoever, I'm going to watch this at the cinema, I've got a week off, or I'm going to enjoy going to the nightclubs, whatever we each do at Christmas. But actually, if you have conflict at Christmas, then it seems made worse by the festive season. So I suppose I kind of tap into that a little bit. And in Let It Snow, there's illness coming up to Christmas and, you know, people can't leave someone else on their own at Christmas. It wouldn't be fair. And so that affects their life. But mainly readers do want all the Christmas pleasant bits. They want to think about mince pies and Swiss chocolate and Christmas markets and Glühwein and Bratwurst and all the Christmas food. They want to think about parties and Christmas songs, obviously, with the title of Let It Snow. You won't be surprised to hear that there's a singing group in the book. And so it's all bringing all these things together and just giving people a real feel of Christmas.
I suppose it's the contrast between light and dark. You have to have some dark for the light to shine through, and you have to have some separation for the coming together to mean more for people.
I think that if you don't make the readers at least suspect that you're not going to be able to bring it off, that you're not going to be able to make the hero and heroine have their happy ending, then in a way you've kind of failed. You need to then go back and see what you can do. And I do tend to give my characters quite meaty conflicts in the same way that my summer books are more than about sun and sea. My Christmas books are more about more than baubles and mince pies. So Isaac has lost his business through no fault of his own, and he's ended up looking after somebody else's pub over Christmas just to keep his head above water while the last of the accountancy type things are happening with his old business. His dad's ill, his ex-girlfriend becomes ill and he has to help her. Lily has these big family dynamic problems. Her sister, who she's been brought up with as her sister, but of course isn't actually a blood sister, takes it very hard that Lily wants to find her biological family. And so these are all very real issues and part of the family dynamic. I also bring internet dating into it and have, if people have read some of my middle bit books before, they might have seen Carola as a secondary character losing her husband and having her difficulties in that direction, and she starts internet dating and it doesn't go well for her. So I really reflect society as I see it, but you do need, as I say, more. You need more grit in there, or else you won't make the pearl in the oyster, I suppose.
Absolutely, and as someone who grew up in a small country village, personal problems actually tend to become community issues.
Yeah.
People do look out for each other. And what I love about your books is that the characters do thread in and out of each other's stories. You come back to characters who you last encountered two or three novels ago, and you find out what's going on with them. And you find out that, yeah, actually, they are still in the background and they do still care, and they can be quite significant parts of the plot.
Yeah, they can. That's true. I'm glad if you are a village dweller that it resonates well with you. I think that it's not a question of planning, oh, I'll have this character in this book. It's the ones who want to come on stage because they fit with the story. My last publisher actually asked for the hero of my first book in Middle Dip, Ratty, to come on stage in Dream a Little Dream, and he just didn't want to. It would have been contrived. But in another situation, he does. He pops up at the pub or the garage, and then I think it feels natural. And one of the reasons I like writing set in a village is that people do fall over each other all the time. I do write books set in other places, but then you have to have a different unifying factor, like in The Christmas Promise, a lot of people worked for the same guy. Because in London, the chances of you turning up at the same bar as someone are a lot less than in a village with one pub. And I do like the community feel you mention. I think as well, though, as the people caring, you do get the people poking their nose into each other's business a bit as well.
Oh, yes, definitely. So what will you be doing this Christmas?
Well, I tend to spend Christmas Day quite quietly, just with my very close family. We have a big lunch, which sadly I'm responsible for. I've never been able to successfully delegate that, although I do delegate some of the clearing up, and spend the day quite quietly, maybe something on the TV, reading, box of chocolates, glass of whiskey or wine. Boxing Day is a big family thing with my husband's side of the family, and then a couple of days later we will host a big family thing for my side of the family, because you just can't get everybody together on Christmas Day. Families, they kind of spread out. They marry and split up, and people get new boyfriends and new girlfriends and stuff, and you can't just get them all in one room. And then I will have a fairly quiet time over New Year's Eve, because for some reason I'm not a great fan of all the hoopla, and go back to work refreshed in early January, quite happy. I will see the new Star Wars film as well. I know I've mentioned that already, but it's one of my treats at Christmas.
Excellent. And are you able not to pay a visit to your Middle Dip family over the Christmas holidays?
Not entirely, because they come into my mind. So I do turn my laptop off and try and keep it off. And I like to see friends as well and have a cup of tea with people that you don't always have time for during the working week and things like that. But they will come into my mind, and I know better than to let an idea go. And so I have the notes facility on my phone and I make use of that. And then when I do turn my laptop on again, by the magic of current technology, the notes appear on my laptop and I've done a little bit of work without trying.
Sue Moorcroft, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and have a very, very happy Christmas.
Thank you very much, Red, and I wish you and everybody at R&IB Connect the same.
Oh, if you only knew the hours we talked about it. Everything, anything I thought of doing just felt as if it would make my wrong wronger. Risk my family and risk his family. If we told you the truth and you wanted to find him, it would change the entire dynamic of our family. You and Zinnia, Patsy and me. Lily, don't hate me. You had two mothers and a sister. I wanted it to be enough.
Stephanie Racine narrating Let It Snow, written by my guest Sue Moorcroft. Thanks to HarperCollins, all Sue Moorcroft's Middle Dip Christmas novels can be found in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Let It Snow is TB 704832 and it's narrated by Stephanie Racine. For more information on it and all the books featured on this week's show, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
To donate £5 to RNIB this Christmas, please text SANTA to 70456. Texts are charged at £5 plus one standard network rate charge. Your special gift will help more blind and partially sighted people get the support they need to live life to the full. Thank you. See Christmas differently with RNIB Connect Radio.
It's as much a part of Christmas as Santa, mince pies and a tree. Slade's evergreen hit, Merry Christmas Everybody, first topped the charts in December 1973 and has sold more than a million copies in the UK alone. But what's the story behind the song? The band's frontman, Noddy Holder, has written his autobiography, titled Who's Crazy Now? He joined me in the studio for a special Christmas interview. So here it is, Merry Christmas, everybody's having... Well, Noddy, you've written two books.
I have.
Your autobiography, Who's Crazy Now?
Yeah.
And The World According to Noddy.
Yeah.
Life Lessons Learned in and Out of Rock
yes,
and Roll.
Yes, correct.
Which did you enjoy writing most?
Well, I enjoyed both of them because I came at both of them from a different angle. I was commissioned on both of them. I didn't present them to the publishers at all. Both books were commissioned. The autobiography was commissioned way back in the turn of the millennium, or as my long-past mum used to call it, the linoleum. And they said, it's about time you did an autobiography. And I was probably, I'd have been 54 years old at that point. So it probably was time for an autobiography because I'd had rather a colourful life. But the second one, which was The World According to Noddy, it was a series that Constable, the publishers, were doing. And the first one they'd done was The World According to Joan Collins. Uh-huh. And I think for the next year, they wanted somebody at the other end of the spectrum as far removed from Joan Collins as possible. So they picked on me.
Well, I don't know. You've been a male model, a bit of a sex symbol.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I came. Yes, you're right. I did win Rear of the Year once, and I did win Best Tie Wearer once. You know, I've had my fashion moments, even though people would dispute that.
Well, Slade were pretty natty dresses.
You're right there, and I still am, I believe. And I mean, I've got my flat cap on today, very colourful flat cap and scarf matching. Yes, I still like to nattily dress, whatever state I'm in. I find it, actually, if I'm in the supermarket or wandering around and people recognise me, they get disappointed if I'm not wearing a bit of colour. They actually get disappointed if I'm not wearing my top hat with mirrors, but I don't, and platform boots. But I don't wear that anymore, but they do get disappointed. So I like to dress a little bit colourful, and then people sort of don't get too disappointed if I'm not all tarted up, as in the glam rock era.
As somebody who grew up in the 1970s, which were a pretty drab time, and glam rock provided all the colour and the excitement and the experimentation.
It certainly did, and I think that's what happens in times of misery. It happened in the 20s, when the recession was on then. Showbiz became very colourful. And there again in the glam rock era, The country was going to pot, basically, much as it is today. You know, you had the three-day week. There were strikes everywhere. The miners were striking. The grave diggers were striking. The bakers were striking. Power cuts were going off 10 o'clock at night. So there was no TV or light. And I think bands like us provided a bit of fantasy land, showbiz, a bit of colourful existence to people's lives, because the country was in a mess. And I think that's why us particularly, Slade particularly, became so big at the time, because our records were pretty much colourful, rowdy records, cheerful records, and it put people in a good mood.
Incredibly easy to sing along to.
Correct.
And fun as well. I always got the impression that you were really enjoying yourself.
We did. We had a great time in those days. I mean, we were young lads, four young lads from the Black Country, the middle of England, working class. You know, we didn't never had any money or anything like that. You know, we'd spent like 10 years working in bands before we had a hit record, various bands. When we did get that taste of success, we made the most of it. Who'd have ever thought, you know, four guys from our hometown would be flying first class around the world, staying in first class hotels, visiting Tokyo, Sydney, New York, San Francisco, all these colourful towns that we'd only seen on the movies. It was great for us, and it was fantastic.
But something that really comes out of the book, whilst it was great fun, it was also very hard graft, wasn't it?
Well, we were a road band. We were a touring band. So not only did we tour constantly, we also had to fit in the recording and the writing of the songs, of course, in between the touring. So it was certainly from about 1970 through to about 76, 77, we never actually had a break. It was constant on a roller coaster, really. It was hard.
Were you surprised by the success?
We were. We always knew from the first day we formed, we always knew we'd got something from our first rehearsal. We sort of clicked. We knew we'd got something different. Of course, when you go into the music business, you never think you're going to make a living out of it at first. And it was a long struggle with the lineup as became successful. It was 5 years before we had a hit record. We were slumming it around the clubs and pubs and everywhere, trying to earn a living just to feed ourselves. And then we met Chas Chandler, who was the guy. He was in the Animals, the band The Animals, and he discovered, produced, managed Jimi Hendrix. So we got the benefit of his experience in and out of bands, and we spent another 2 years with him before we had a breakthrough on the charts. It was a surprise when you finally make the chart. It is a surprise, but you don't know what's hit you then. But certainly for a band like us, because when we appeared on Top of the Pops, which in those days had probably 18 to 20 million viewers a week, you got a big audience seeing you. And whether you liked us or not, you were talking about us, because we made an impact on that show. And we basically became the house band on that show. It was a whirlwind. Once we got the first hit, then the next hit record we had was a number one for 4 or 5 weeks. And then the next one, it just took off so big. And it was so fast. And the record company were demanding at least 3 singles a year, at least 1 album a year, sometimes 2. Just getting the hit is the first step on the ladder.
We've got to talk about the big Christmas hit. Now, I hear there's a story behind that song, that actually it was a challenge that was issued by Jim Lee's mother-in-law.
It was. It was Jim's mother-in-law who said to him one day, why can't you write a song that would be coming out every year? Not necessarily a Christmas song, but a birthday song, an Easter song, a summer song, whatever. He sort of took that as a challenge from his mother-in-law. I think he thought she was saying that we weren't good enough to come up with something like that. And he remembered a song that I'd written, actually the first song I'd written, way back in 1967. And it was in the hippie days. And it was a sort of hippy-dippy ditty. And it was called Buy Me a Rocking Chair to Watch the World Go By. And it was very psychedelic era type thing. And I played it to the band. The band said rubbish. So it went in the bin. But six years later, Jim remembered this song that I'd written, particularly the chorus, the hook. And he put a new verse to it. He remembered the chorus. He got this verse melody. He played it me and it sort of fitted together. Then I went away and wrote a Christmas lyric to it. All in one night, actually. I went to the pub and had a few drinks. I was staying at my mum and dad's house in Walsall in the West Midlands that night from the pub, and I sat up all night and I did the lyrics in one fell swoop during the night with a few shots of whiskey in between. And it sort of clicked. It sort of clicked into place very quickly. Went back to Jim's a couple of days later, played him what I'd got lyrically and that, and it all clicked. And we played it to Chas Chandler, our manager and producer. We played it to him and he said, well, the record company have been crying out, because by that time, we'd already had a lot of hits and five number ones by that time. It was 73. We'd had Come On, Feel the Noise was a number one that year. We'd had Squeeze Me, Please Me a number one that year. And the record company had been crying out for us to bring out a single at Christmas, which we'd never done before. Not necessarily a Christmas song, just a single at Christmas. And Chas heard it and he said, well, the record company will be freaked out. You've come up with this. We didn't tell them, didn't tell the record company that we'd got a Christmas song. But we scheduled a Christmas release. At the end of the tour, European tour we'd done in July, we ended it at Earl's Court in London, which is the first big rock gig that had ever been performed there. 5 days later, Don Pell had a horrendous car crash. Mm. His girlfriend was killed and he was hospitalised for 6 weeks. The doctors didn't give him 24 hours to live. So it was a very downer period for us, and we'd got this Christmas song sitting there. Didn't know whether Don was going to survive. He was that ill and knocked about that we decided to take him to New York to get him back behind the drum kit, because he had no memory, he had no taste of smell, his body was wrecked. We took him to America to coax him back behind the drums, because the doctors said that's the only way he'll ever play again. So we took him into a studio in New York at the end of August. The most un-Christmassy type of atmosphere you could ever have had. He couldn't remember the 4 minutes from start to finish. He couldn't play it on the drums because his memory was shot. So we had to piece it together in little bits, which we'd never recorded like that before. So it's all it's like a jigsaw puzzle, that record, how it's put together. And we thought, this is not going to work. It's not going to work, this. It's just too disjointed and whatever. And then it was mixed. We went off on tour to sort of get Don playing again, and we went off on tour in America. Chas mixed it in the studio in New York, and he brought it back to the record company in Britain. We'd not really heard it. We'd sort of heard a rough mix of it. But he brought it back to the record company in UK, and they flipped. And this was probably in September time. They flipped and they said, this is just a great record. This is going to be, because we were top of the tree for sales in Europe at that time. They said, this is going to be such a monster record. We came back and it was all in place. The record company had scheduled the release date. They'd scheduled appearances on Top of the Pops. They'd scheduled appearances in Europe on TV shows. The release date was the first week in December. We had 500,000 advance orders, which in those days was a silver record. You got a gold for a million in those days. You get a gold for much less these days. But in those days, we got a silver record pre-orders before it came out. And on the first day of reorder, on the Monday, because we'd premiered it on Top of the Pops, it went straight to number one the first day of release. And the first day of reorder, it did 360,000 records in one day, the first reorder. And they had to go to Europe, to the pressing plants in Europe, to press the singles up, because they couldn't cope on the factories in UK alone. We're having records shipped in from America, Europe, everywhere, to keep up the demand. And we'd done a million. By the time Christmas Day came, we'd done a million on the single. It was the fastest selling single up to that point in the UK. It took a life of its own. It got a life of its own once the initial furore was over about it in 1973. It's never been deleted. It's always been released every year. You know, nothing to do with us, just the record company keeps it afloat every year. And it's still going as strong now as it ever was. We never thought for a minute a song like that would be going 46 years later. We never imagined it would be.
Do you ever get tired of hearing it?
I don't, actually, no. It's one of those things that I'd probably get a different glow from it to what the public gets from it, because I'm so used to it. And I sort of relate it more to the time of the band, to the accident that Don had, how he took to record it, the trauma we were going through as a band at the time, whether we're going to survive with the same lineup as the band. I relate to it more in that way than probably the success it had in 1973. You know, it's weird when you're actually performing on a record, you relate to it in a different way. And it was a traumatic time for the band. As I say, we were top of the tree in Europe and Australia. We'd had so many record sales and so much success and massive tours, and it could all crumble in one day because of this accident. You know, it was a weird time for us, weird.
I was interviewing Charlie Greamer, the drummer from Wizard.
Oh, I know Charlie, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a good old Brummie.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, you pit them to the post
yeah.
In 1973 for the number one.
Yeah, yeah.
And
which Woody still reminds me of. I still see Woody regularly. He still reminds me.
And, of course, there was the custard pie incident.
Ah, yeah, yes, okay.
How do you remember that?
Well, we were on there doing the Christmas Day Top of the Pops. The Christmas Day Top of the Pops is always the number ones from the year. Ours was the current number one, the last number one of that year, 73. So we were finishing the show. We'd already played two songs on the show because we'd had two other number ones that year. So had Woody. He'd had See My Baby Joy that year. So we were all there, and we knew Wizard, and we knew all the guys in Wizard, particularly Woody. I mean, we'd all grown up in Birmingham playing the same clubs and seeing one another's bands, so we knew one another really well. It came to the end of the harmony bit at the end of our Christmas record, finishing off Top of the Pops. And, of course, Woody and all the Wizard mob, they all come with custard pies. They'd had them already. So as I'm finishing off the vocals, they all splattered me with custard pies, yeah. And that's how the show ended that year, yeah.
Noddy Holder, thank you so much for being our special Christmas guest on Read On, and have a very, very Merry Christmas.
And you too. Merry Christmas!
Fabulous. Both Who's Crazy Now and The World According to Noddy are out now in print and ebook, and let's hope Noddy decides to record audio versions of them both.
Thanks to Red Sail and, of course, to Noddy Holder. That's almost it for our Christmas show, but if you're listening to the podcast, stay tuned because there's an extra 15 minutes of Noddy coming up in a moment. If you're listening on RNIB Connect Radio and want to hear that podcast, just search for RNIB Audiobook Show and it should be the first result. You can download it and listen via your smart device, be it phone, tablet or smart speaker. Next week is the 150th show, and it's a special, an hour in the company of John le Carré. That will be broadcast and available as a podcast from December the 20th. For more information, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at talking_books, and Red is at Red Sail, REDSZELL. And now, just for listeners of the podcast, here's more from Noddy Holder picking up where he left off.
Happy days.
That's the fun you had in those days. You see, probably it's got very cool now. The whole scene's very cool. You don't see many bands smiling when they're on telly or nothing. With us, it was all, especially with us and Wizard, you know, you had a laugh when you were on TV. You had a good time. We weren't trying to be cool. I don't think we could have been cool. If we had tried, we couldn't have been cool. We weren't that sort of band. When you come from the Midlands especially, there is a certain humour there in the Black Country and the Birmingham. You don't want to get things mixed up with the Black Country and Birmingham. It's two different things. People class it all together.
I have been warned.
but we do share a particularly dark sense of humour. We find fun and laughs in things you shouldn't find fun and laughs in, especially in those days. And when you've been on the road and were knocking around as long as we'd been, and certainly as long as Roy would have been and the lads in his band, we'd all been through the mill. We weren't like overnight successes. We'd all paid our dues. We'd all worked the German clubs. We'd all been on the road for years. Of course, Woody had been in two successful bands already. He'd formed The Move, so he'd had a big string of success with The Move, with a lot of hit records. He formed ELO with Jeff Lynne, so he'd had a few hits with them. Then he left that band and then formed Wizard. So we'd all been through the mill.
And you clearly love performing, and you've gone on to a successful acting career. I remember you in The Grimleys.
Yeah, yeah.
Playing yourself as a violin teacher.
Yeah.
And you still do quite a lot of voiceover work, don't you?
I do a lot of voiceover work, yeah. It's still... I worked in radio for over 20 years. I had shows on different stations in radio, which is still a form of performing. Mm. Different way of performing, but still a way of performing. How that came about, really, was in America, on our last tour of America, I was going into a studio to do an interview in LA, in Los Angeles. They were surprised at my knowledge of the music industry. They said, do you want to come in one night while you're still in LA and present a show? And I thought, yeah, great, I'll go in. And I got to the studio and the news broke while I was there, that Marvin Gaye had been shot. And I was a big fan of black soul music. So obviously, being LA, they had to do a tribute show to him immediately, which I hosted off the cuff, and they loved it. It gave me a thrill of radio. So when I come back to UK, I'd had offers of presenting before, and so I started to do bits of presenting, and it just grew and grew to weekly shows, etc., which I did do for quite a long time.
And The World According to Noddy actually grew out of that, didn't it?
It did. The publishers heard me and they heard my outlook on life, what I thought about education, what I thought about politics, what I thought about fashion, what I thought about everyday life, really. And that's why they picked me. I mean, I don't do social media now. Everybody keeps telling me, you should be tweeting, you should be doing this. I don't do any of that. People using my name do it, which they shouldn't be. But pretty much I was doing that on radio years ago, you know, spouting what I thought. And that's how the book did come about.
And seeing as you are a voiceover artist, is there any chance that you might record audiobook versions of your two books?
I've never been asked. Maybe I wouldn't mind doing it, but they've never really asked me to do it. So maybe in the future, yeah, I would quite enjoy it, I think.
Clearly got a great story to tell on both sides, and well, maybe we can get you back in to do it.
Well, the books were very different. I went at the autobiography, which I co-wrote with a lady called Lisa Veraco, who used to be the music critic of The Times. I chose her. They gave me a list of six people to write with. I knew some of them, but I didn't know her. And I picked her because she knew nothing about Slade. She was much younger than me. And I thought she'd come at it from a very fresh point of view. She didn't grow up with us or anything. And so basically, I wrote totally on my own my young days before Slade. And I sort of did interviews with her, and she pieced together the Slade part of the book. It needed somebody to, edit it instead of me just waffling on, and sort of put it from a fresh point of view, really, and that's why I chose her to sort of ghostwrite the Slade part of the book. I think it worked. Because I'd done it into a tape machine, she'd got the feel of how I speak and my sense of humour, etc. And she did the rough draft, and then I came to it and then chopped and changed stuff to make it sound like it was from my point of view and not somebody interviewing me and doing it, you know. So I wouldn't say that, or I wouldn't say it like that, and that's how I worked it.
Are you a keen reader yourself?
I used to be on the road, but not so much now. But still buy books. Some of them, they sit on shelves for ages. My wife's a big reader, and she's an author herself. She writes plays and books, so she reads constantly. So there's always been books in the house. My kids all read, so we are a big reading family. But I used to read all the time on the road. Used to get through tons of books on the road. I'm more of a TV addict now. I watch tons of TV, and there's so much TV to catch up on, because I do like watching, particularly dramas and stuff like that, and documentaries. So I spend more time watching TV than I do reading books, which is wrong. I mean, I should have kept up reading books more so than I have done. But I always loved reading. I loved reading when I was at school. I did O-level, what it was called in those days, GCSEs. I did that in English literature and English language. And I read some of the real heavyweight classics in those days, because we did have to do it for the syllabus in those days. So I did read a lot of stuff when I was a kid. I mean, I always remember the first books I ever read as a very little kid. I mean, my mum used to brag that I was reading books at two. I don't believe it for a minute, but, you know, mums say about their kids. But she always said that. But I do remember, you know, at the age of four and five, reading Treasure Island, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, these sort of books, Dickens books, even at that age. I might not have understood every word it said, but I certainly understood the stories at that age. And I've always had a love of storytelling, which probably overlapped into the singing, the songwriting, of course. And having a book, having books out, I mean, it was a great ambition for me. I never thought I'd do it, like I never thought I'd be a successful rock star. But, you know, these things come your way in life, you know, they cross your path in life, and you jump on them when you get the chance.
Well, yeah, and to have two books by Noddy Holder sitting in the British Library for the rest of time, it's quite an achievement, isn't it?
I like it. I like the thought of it, yeah, absolutely. It certainly stands alongside my achievements as a musician as well. I'd certainly put it on a par with it, the same as I would with stuff I've acted in. As you say, I was in the Grimleys for several series over a five-year period. When I first did it, they had me in on the pilot just to do a cameo appearance, singing a song. And then the writer, Jed Mercurio, who is now the biggest writer on TV, he wrote the Grimleys, he was a Midlands lad, he said to me, do you fancy doing the series? Not just a cameo, but a part in the first series. I said, yeah, great, you know. And he gave me quite a bit to do in the first series. I was not an experienced actor by any stretch, but I learnt as I went along. And then the next series gave me bigger part and more to do. And when it came, as the series went on and on and on and on, I became a much, much bigger part. I was the headmaster of the school in the last series. And that also stands besides, you know, the other things I've done. I was in Coronation Street, the live 40th episode of Coronation Street. That was a lifetime ambition for me. I mean, I absolutely adored Coronation Street. I'd watched it right from the day one. And I was at, it was actually the time I was doing the Grimleys, one of the series of the Grimleys, and I was at an awards ceremony, and I was sitting on the table next to the Coronation Street mob, who I knew most of them from Granada television. So I knew a lot of the cast and the producers and whatever, and they're sitting on the next table, and they're taking the mickey. We'd all had a few drinks. It was late at night. They were taking the mickey. They knew the 40th live ep was coming up. And they're all saying to the producer, oh, you should give Noddy a part. He's an actor now. He's doing the Grimleys. Give him a part. Give him a part. It was all drunken talk late at night. That was a Saturday night. And then the Monday morning, my manager got a call from the producer saying, will Noddy do a cameo in Coronation Street? As a character, not as myself. I mean, it was terrifying, really. Live ep, and it was Coronation Street. And I saved the cobbles. My character came in to save the cobbles on the street because they were going to be dug up and tarmacked over. The road was going to be tarmacked over. So my character saved the cobbles. But that was a great thrill for me. And it was nerve-wracking, very nerve-wracking. But it was a great thrill to be on a show like Coronation Street. And then following off to that, I did the movie version of Bob the Builder.
Yep.
I was a character in Bob the Builder. With Elton John, and Chris Evans was the other guest stars, but I had quite a big part in Bob the Builder. It was the first movie they did, and I've done stuff with Peter Kay on, you know, in his Max and Paddy series. So I've done bits and dabs over the years. I still get offered quite a lot of acting roles. The reason I don't do more now, mostly what I get offered, frazzled rock and roll stars on the edge of suicide, drunken, drugged, addled rock and roll stars. So usually I'll give them a miss.
Well, I'm hoping that having suggested that you become an audiobook narrator, that the idea will stick and that we'll be seeing more of you in these studios in years to come.
Well, that'd be good. That'd be good. I'd love it.
And finally, Noddy was behind one of the doors on RNIB Connect Radio's advent calendar. Behind today's door is a very special guest. Lead singer of Slade, Noddy Holder, arguably most famous for Merry Christmas Everybody, tells Red Sail about some of his Christmas favourites.
Can I ask you to tell me what your favourite Christmas film is?
Christmas film?
Mm.
Oh, dear. Let me think. I think I'd probably have to say It's a Wonderful Life. I think that's probably the one, because that movie came out, it wasn't a success. When it first came out, nobody sort of went to see it or understood it. But of course, it has become a classic.
How do you know that Santa Claus has visited the house?
Oh, well, you see, I'm a big pal of Santa's. If he's overloaded with stuff, I help him out. I help him on the sleigh, because he gets very busy Christmas Eve. And he can't always get all around the world in one fell swoop. So I'm actually his helper. I know him really well. And don't tell anybody. But, when you see the snow footprints in the lounge, sometimes they're mine. Sometimes they're mine, because he might be up there on the sleigh, and there's some chimneys these days he can't get down because he's too big. But I'm a bit slimmer than him, so I come down and actually put the prezzies under the tree and leave the footprints.
And do you have a favourite Christmas tradition?
My Christmas tradition really is cooking the Christmas dinner. I'm a good cook, and my family always want me to cook the Christmas dinner. Mm. They love my Christmas dinner. This year, for the first time, I'm not cooking the Christmas dinner. For the first time ever. So I'm having it cooked for me. So that'll be a tradition broken. People think, they think at Christmas I sit at home playing my own record and wallowing in my own voice over the Christmas period. It doesn't quite work like that. We don't really sit down and listen to Slade's Christmas record for 24 hours on Christmas Day. No, it doesn't work like that.
That does bring me on to my next question. What is your favourite Christmas song?
I love Slade's record. I love Roy Wood's record. I love John Lennon's record. I love the Pogues' record. I love a lot of Christmas records. I love the old Phil Spector Christmas album. I love the old sloppy crooner Christmas stuff. But my favourite, and the reason it's my favourite, is because it reminds me of a Motown song, is Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. I think it's a great pop record, a great pop record. And here's the lovely Mariah, diva that she is. Merry Christmas!
Fabulous.
That's it for this podcast. We'll get a copyright strike if I play too much of that song. The 150th show is available from next week, from December the 20th, an hour in the company of John le Carré. Please like and subscribe to this podcast wherever you found it, and if you can, leave a review. Thanks for listening, and have a very Merry Christmas.